Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, focused on the management of breast cancer, and as a follow-up to a recent live CME symposium we did at the 2023 ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with one of the faculty members from the CME meeting, Dr. Kevin Kalinske from the Winship Cancer Institute at Emory University in Atlanta. To begin, during the meeting at ASCO, we reviewed a number of key decision points in the management of breast cancer. And to begin, I presented one of these scenarios in HER2-positive metastatic disease to Dr. Kalinske, a patient who received first-line treatment with pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and docetaxel, and then had a partial response to second-line therapy with T-DXd, but who then developed a solitary brain metastasis that was resected while on therapy.
I think that this is where our paradigm shifts with the availability of new targeted therapies. I think in this particular circumstance, this is an agent, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan is one which we know has CNS penetration. There have been data now that have been published that have been, you know, demonstrating this in some small series. I think in this particular circumstance, if there was stable disease systemically and then there was a lesion that we could do some stereotactic radiotherapy or some targeted treatment, I think it's reasonable to do that and continue on trastuzumab deruxtecan. I think if this was the sort of circumstance where it may be a molecule where we're not as convinced that there is CNS penetration, then that may be the sort of circumstance where I would think about switching to another agent, including tucatinib-based regimen if they haven't received it before. But I think in this circumstance, that's what I would do is continue local therapy and then change at the time of systemic progression.
So same situations, Cleopatra first line, but T-DM1 second line response. Would that make you think differently?
It would. I'm not as convinced. You know, there are some data in the context of patients, for instance, receiving whole brain radiation therapy suggesting that maybe there could be some activity with T-DM1, some data that had been presented a few years ago. But I'm not as convinced in the absence of that sort of circumstance that there's really good CNS coverage, and that would be a circumstance that I would think about switching to systemic therapy.
I'm curious where you see tucatinib heading. One of the things that I learned actually in preparing for the conference in ASCO that I hadn't heard before was, you know, I always think about tucatinib, you know, adding in brain protection, but I started hearing people talking about the fact that it upregulates HER2. And that maybe it would be synergistic with other HER2 therapies, T-DXd, T-DM1, et cetera. Any thoughts about that idea?
Yeah, I mean, there are some strategies that are looking at this approach. Like, for instance, there's a study, TUC-025, which is in the metastatic setting, which is looking at combining trastuzumab deruxtecan plus tucatinib. You know, I've always wondered, you know, do we need to be giving tucatinib in the regimen that we're giving with HER2-CLIMB, right? Like, we're restricted really for utilizing along with capecitabine plus trastuzumab. But I think certainly there's a rationale for combining it with other agents, and hopefully we'll see the results of that phase 2 study, which is looking at safety and efficacy of the combo.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting. In our HER2-positive colorectal cancer, they use tucatinib and trastuzumab without capecitabine. It's approved, it's used, pretty good response rate, and that is actually being studied in other cancers. Is that strategy being thought about in breast cancer to get rid of the capecitabine?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's remained an important question. The studies that I know about are combinations with other, with antibody drug conjugates, for instance. I don't know of any other strategies offhand that are looking at combining it with, for instance, other chemotherapy partners. But one has to also, you know, there are other studies, for instance, which like there's an ongoing randomized phase 3 trial that's looking at patients frontline who had response to a Cleopatra-like regimen and then are on maintenance HER2 target therapy and then randomizing them to tucatinib with or without, you know, or placebo. And so there is the potential that we'll see tucatinib given with other agents. And the other thing I just want to mention is that there's the residual disease study that's ongoing, the COMPASS-RD study, which is looking at T-DM1 with or without tucatinib in the residual disease post-neoadjuvant setting.
Interesting. Well, getting back to T-DXd, another thing that we were talking about and always comes up, and it's interesting too to compare notes about what you hear about this from other cancers where T-DXd is used, lung cancer, GI cancers, et cetera, which is the issue of screening for ILD and management of ILD. And we've been telling, these other groups that you all are more and more, I'm hearing you talk about, doing imaging, looking for early ILD, even in patients who don't need imaging of the chest. Is that something you do, and how often do you do it?
I feel like as a community, we're a bit all over the place with how frequently we are doing our systemic imaging. If we look at the trials and really the book answer or how I'm commonly assessing patients is by doing CT scans of the chest every 6 weeks. I think that it becomes a bit redundant and patients don't love getting that frequency of scans. I know other colleagues who are doing images every 9 weeks, some that are doing it even less frequent than that. I would say that I'm at least doing it every 9 weeks. I will also tell you, I have a circumstance in my clinic, like in the last couple of weeks, where I was doing chest CTs every 6 weeks. We were a little bit off for that next CT scan. And then turns out the patient then started to have shortness of breath.
Wow.
Then we did a CT scan. She's symptomatic. She had high dose steroids. And we're just a little bit outside of that every 6 week window. I mean, that's an anecdote. But I also think the thing to know is that this toxicity isn't something that happens necessarily just within the first couple of months. It could be something that happens a little bit later on as well. And so if you're doing imaging every 6 weeks for the first couple of months, it is important to know that it's not just something that happens up front. It can be a little bit later while patients are on their T-DXd.
And a related question is re-challenge after ILD with T-DXd. Sort of the thing that in general I keep hearing from breast cancer people, again, not necessarily some of the others, is if you have symptoms, you're generally not going to get it again. And that's why you guys look so hard to try to pick it up before it becomes symptomatic. Is that the way you approach this?
Fully. That is exactly how I approach it. If it's grade two or higher, which is really when patients are symptomatic, the approach is to not rechallenge patients.
I'm curious what your experience is with T-DXd in terms of, quote, chemotherapy-like side effects, GI side effects, et cetera, et cetera. What have you seen and what do you tell your patients about?
The main chemo-like symptom that I've seen has been fatigue.
Hmm.
It's a once every 3 week infusion. Not everybody loses their hair. There are some gastrointestinal potential side effects, including nausea, but we pre-medicate prophylactically with antiemetics pretty intensely at the beginning. We give IV antiemetics, et cetera. And I would say in our experience, the main toxicity that we've seen has been fatigue.
We were doing a program on biliary tract cancers, and they bring up this HER2-targeted bispecific antibody, zanidatamab. And I'm like, I don't think I heard about that in breast cancer. Has it been studied in breast cancer? Any comments on this molecule?
Yeah, no, it is an interesting molecule. There are some initial data. There are actually conversations about evaluating this even in the neoadjuvant setting. So it is an agent that is of interest.
And what's your understanding about, how it works and, why it has a different effect, I guess, than trastuzumab?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's also this hope that it's also causing this immune-related sort of phenomena as well. I think that there are a number of questions that remain. There are toxicities that are seen with this agent as well, including gastrointestinal issues. But it will be curious to see as well with the development whether this is the sort of agent that is better used early on as opposed to in the pretreated population.
curious too that, you know, it looks like there's data in biliary tract cancer before breast cancer, which kind of shows you the ubiquity of HER2 trials going on right now. I feel like we're talking about it in a lot of different cancers. Another thing that we talked about at the meeting, and I'm curious what your take is. It's an old topic, but or you know, semi-old, but just curious now. We've had so many changes in management of localized disease. Neratinib, post-adjuvant neratinib. What are the situations where you use this agent?
So even to take a step back, you know, the data that led to the approval of neratinib were from the EXTINENT study. And just going back to one of the things that I'd said earlier, sometimes when the data are reported, the field has already changed. And that was one of the circumstances with EXTINENT, right? These patients really didn't receive pertuzumab. These patients who had residual disease didn't receive T-DM1. And so I restrict the utilization, one, for the patients with hormone receptor positive disease, and subsequent reports, including data that were published in Clinical Breast Cancer, was really that population, the hormone receptor positive, HER2 positive population, who really seem to benefit. I would say I utilize it in patients who have significant disease. And by that, I mean, you know, patients who have node positive disease or a lot of residual disease at their time of their surgery. Sometimes it's a bit of a hard sell to convince patients to take another year of HER2-targeted therapy. And I think the other thing is I mentioned the COMPASS-RD study and the potential utility for tucatinib. I think in the metastatic setting, we're in general agreement that tucatinib is the TKI-preferred agent of choice. And the question is going to be, based upon COMPASS-RD, whether tucatinib really removes neratinib from the adjuvant space, if we're going to be thinking ahead in terms of where tucatinib may be placed in the adjuvant setting.
Although it's always great to avoid metastatic disease. And I mean, I was amazed, you know, the hazard rate in ER positive was like 0.6.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about in the adjuvant setting that absolute delta of benefit being about 5% or so. But then one has to ask the question, okay, well, if I had a patient who received pertuzumab and T-DM1, like really, is that the sort of delta of benefit that we'll be seeing?
Right. In the situations where it is utilized, what's your take in terms of minimizing toxicity? Of course, the big issue's been diarrhea. I hear, you know, it sounds like dose escalation has been pretty effective in avoiding that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the strategy that we utilize. You know, there have been studies that have looked at different ways of preventing toxicity. And so we slowly dose increase. And I think that that's made a difference in terms of tolerability.
So I want to talk a little bit about ER positive disease, and we'll start out talking about localized disease. And first, just to get an update on where we are and where you are in terms of genomic evaluation and the use of chemotherapy, primarily the recurrence score. And of course, a lot of questions and discussion about node positive disease and your work on the R-Xponder trial. And I guess one of the big questions that I hear people talking about is in those unusual situations where you have more than four positive nodes in a patient with a low recurrence score, are you still given chemo?
So this was, you know, there have been ASCO guidelines that followed the reporting of responder. And this was something that we debated about whether we should be fully restrictive. And the consensus was to not utilize a genomic assay for patients with N2 disease. I will say, are there circumstances where it's wrong to do that? If you had a patient who was older, you know, had an unattended to breast cancer that was strongly hormone receptor positive with low Ki-67, is it wrong to do that? I'm not sure that it is. We don't have data in this setting. So it's always important to know that if you're checking a recurrence score in this sort of population, that we don't have data in the prospective randomized setting. I will also say, you know, there's the ongoing Optima study, which is looking at the utility of PAM50. And in that study, they're including both N1 and N2 disease. So we'll get some N2 data from the prospective setting. I would say the textbook answer is to not check in an N2 disease. But again, if there's some outlier circumstances, it's not something I commonly do in my practice, but it's not based upon biology, there may be utility.
I guess the thing that I think about is, do you bring it up to the patient? I mean, if you have a patient who's a physician, for example, who can maybe understand better than other patients some of the subtleties, is this something you would raise? Or if a patient's hesitating about chemotherapy, would you, you know, consider presenting to them the option of avoiding it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if a patient needs convincing and is a very savvy patient, it may be a circumstance where I would check it. I'm actually trying to think of if there is a circumstance where in my clinic I have checked it. I can't think of a circumstance. I will also tell you, if we think about the population and responder who had three nodes, it's underrepresented in responder. You know, it's less than 10% of patients had three nodes. The majority of patients had one node. And so I do start to feel a little uncomfortable once we start exceeding three nodes, because even with responder, it's the minority of patients.
So another issue that came out of responder that, you know, I think is really interesting, leads into another topic, was the issue of ovarian suppression and ablation, and how much of the benefit that we're seeing, since so many of the patients in these studies did not have that. What are the situations where you're bringing up ovarian suppression ablation as an alternative to chemotherapy?
Yeah. I mean, I think it would be interesting to do a study comparing how much gray hair I had before responder and how much I have now, because this is the thing that I feel like, you know, in the postmenopausal population, I think we had a clear answer. It's 2/3 of the population feel comfortable with the data that we have in that population. It's the premenopausal cohort that I think that there are a lot of questions. Do I think that we're over-treating some patients who are premenopausal, who have a recurrence score 0 to 25? I do. I also think we don't want to be under-treating our patients, right? That's really the concern. We don't have an exact cutoff where we can say, okay, this is a patient where we don't need chemo and we'll do ovarian function suppression. Also understanding that in responder, only about 16% of patients with node-positive disease who are premenopausal underwent ovarian function and suppression. So all that being said, my take on those patients of a recurrence score 0 to 25 is the default is a conversation about chemotherapy. However, if you have a patient who has a low recurrence score, you know, let's say recurrence score 0 to 10, we know that the absolute benefit of chemotherapy is lower than what we see if your recurrence score, say, is 21 to 25. So in these conversations, which are important and careful and tricky conversations with patients, I do say, okay, well, listen, in responder, we know chemotherapy. Do I think that there are patients for whom we could just do ovarian function suppression and hormonal therapy? Absolutely. And so there may be circumstances if a patient has a low recurrence score where we make the decision, okay, well, we'll commit to doing OFS and an AI. But the other thing is, not everybody can tolerate ovarian function suppression. And I think in these conversations, sometimes we underestimate the kinds of toxicities that we can see with OFS. It's not a field day for everybody. And that's also why the NSBP-009 study, which is going to be randomizing patients to OFS plus hormonal therapy with or without chemo, will hopefully help us answer this in a genomically defined population. Until we get those results, though, I think the default is a chemo conversation. But for certain patients, if they opt out, then OFS, I do think, is appropriate.
And that kind of leads into the whole issue of ovarian suppression, and which over the last few months, I've had some interesting thoughts about that I want to share with you. I brought a little bit of this up at the meeting, but we really didn't have too much time to talk about it. And before I get into that, this is really a result of, you know, the surveys we do where we ask people what they do. But before we get into that, I'm curious about your thoughts about the presentation at ASCO. You chaired the session on ovarian suppression by Richard Gray. Of course, he's part of the Oxford group that started doing meta-analyses in the 1980s. And I was kind of surprised when I saw they were doing a presentation on ovarian ablation and suppression. What was your take from that presentation?
I think that, well, one, we've learned a lot from the early breast cancer trialist group. I mean, that's been a really important group from whom we've learned a lot of information. I think my take home from that presentation was that for the patients who had not seen chemotherapy or were premenopausal after their chemotherapy, when they did the same in terms of their benefit of doing ovarian function suppression or not, like those were the patients who really benefited from ovarian function suppression. In the population in those studies where it wasn't clear if they were premenopausal after chemotherapy, that delta of benefit was less. And so that population, to me, remained a little confusing because we have an absence of data of whether they were actually postmenopausal after chemo or not. The other thing that's worth mentioning in the population, again, who didn't get chemo or were premenopausal after chemo, is that if you had tamoxifen, the degree of benefit was a little bit less with ovarian function suppression. And so I think to me, the data presented, you know, reiterated that for some patients, there's a real benefit of OFS. But I still think there remains this question of, is all the benefit that we're seeing from chemotherapy due to the ovarian function suppression effect from chemotherapy? Or is there a difference in biology in premenopausal and postmenopausal patients?
So let me tell you my observation and get your thoughts on it. And it really relates to the use of adjuvant ovarian suppression ablation. And I'm kind of wondering whether or not it might be underutilized in the community. And the reason I say that, even if you look at the literature, you know, in the recent update of Soft and Text editorial, I think it was by Kathy Miller going over this whole issue, I don't believe it mentioned something that we observed that I thought was very interesting, which was when we started to ask investigators, okay, what are the situations in a premenopausal, and we know, sure, it's going to be different in maybe younger premenopausal than older, but in general, what are the situations in premenopausal patients where you use ovarian suppression and ablation? And the answer in general that we got, the initial sort of answer and kind of what you see in the guidelines is in the lower risk patients, which kind of makes sense. You know, it's, as you mentioned, there are, you know, toxicity issues. And once you maybe get to a lower risk, the absolute benefit compared to tamoxifen maybe not be as great. But the thing that we found that was interesting was when we asked, and I'm going to ask you the question, who are the patients, premenopausal patients that you don't use ovarian suppression in? A lot of times what we're hearing is A, node negative, B, small. But the thing that I keep hearing is low oncotype. Mm-hmm. That is a consideration to many investigators in terms of whether or not, so that the phenotype of what I hear that they seriously consider tamoxifen alone is node negative, small tumor, low recurrence score. Is that kind of your thing or no?
I have lots of thoughts. So one, from Soft Text, the patients who benefited from doing ovarian function suppression were the patients who were deemed high enough risk by their treating providers to give chemotherapy, right? Like those were the patients who benefited. I totally agree with you. I think we are underutilizing ovarian function suppression. I think that's been demonstrated in RxPONDER in a modern study, right? Where we saw over time that within the first 5 years that rate of ovarian function suppression never exceeded 16%.
Wow.
And so...
I didn't realize that. Mm-hmm, that's incredible.
Yes. Yeah. And so the other thing I just really want to mention is that there have been other studies. You know, Ruth O'Regan presented data looking at the role of BCI to determine who would benefit from ovarian function suppression or not. At ASCO this year, they presented the data from, you know, utilizing PAM50. And the PAM50 data that was presented at ASCO, you know, having a high score was, or low score, wasn't predictive of who would benefit from ovarian function suppression. And with BCI, the results were the opposite of what we anticipated we were going to see. And so I would say that we don't have any clear data from a genomic assay to determine who needs OFS or not. And the other thing that I want to mention, and this is going to take me a little bit off topic, but to me, these data that were presented during that local regional presentation, I think were really intriguing, is that back to those PAM50 data, Shireen Loy and her group presented data about the young patients, the patients who were 40 years of age or less. And in that presentation, she showed, one, that for those patients, there was a higher rate of luminal B tumors compared to if you were older. And then also, if you had luminal A tumors, even if you were treated the same way, those patients did worse. And when I had made the comment about there being a difference in biology between young women and older patients, those are data that also suggest maybe for our younger patients, the ones who are less than 40 years of age or less, that there is a difference in the underlying biology. And this is why I think that this needs further investigation for us to understand.
So, our primary target audience for our work is the general medical oncologists who are taking care of, CLL, myeloma, et cetera. So we always focus on what people actually do. Yes. So can you describe a typical patient where you're going to use adjuvant tamoxifen and no ovarian suppression?
Yes. And also keep in mind, my brother is a community oncologist in Charleston, right? So I would utilize in a patient who has a low score, premenopausal, node negative, check an oncotype that is low, I completely utilize tamoxifen in those patients. If you have a patient who has high clinical risk and, has a recurrence score 16 to 20 or has a score 21 to 25 and again is node negative, this is a sort of circumstance where I do talk about chemotherapy with patients. And sometimes if I'm giving those patients chemotherapy and those patients are 45 or, less than 40 years of age, and I think that they may be made amenorrheic from their chemotherapy, sometimes I do just give tamoxifen. And then I see if their periods come back. And then if they're no longer menstruating after 2 years, then that's a circumstance that I will transition them from tamoxifen to an aromatase inhibitor. The other thing I want to mention, because in the ASCO guidelines, for the patients who are premenopausal, node positive, meaning 1 to 3 nodes involved, the consensus statement was to not check a recurrence score or a 70-gene assay, the mammoprint assay. I will tell you, in my practice, I am still utilizing a genomic assay in that population. I feel like it offers prognostic information. I mentioned that I may think about a patient who has a recurrent score of 2 a little bit differently than somebody who has a recurrent score of 23. And so I still utilize a genomic assay in that population.
So I might have mentioned it at ASCO, but I don't know if you're aware, there was a really amazing study presented in prostate cancer called the EMBARK trial, where for the first time they used anti-androgen enzalutamide without androgen deprivation therapy, and they saw greater benefit than androgen deprivation therapy. Now they're trying to process what to do, because actually the arm that had both did better. But you just think about the conversation we just had over the last 5 or 10 minutes that we could have done for an hour. Mm-hmm. They don't know anything about that. But amazingly, they're in a very similar situation, except they got there instantly when this trial was presented, whereas you all have had years and years to process it, and this just hit prostate cancer.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've been debating this for some time, and I think without question, they're still concerned that we're over-treating patients. I'm hopeful that the offset trial, which is that the NRG study that I was mentioning, which is including, that Taylor X population where there was a potential benefit of chemotherapy and the responder population was 0 to 25, hopefully that will put the final nail on the coffin in terms of who needs chemo or not. But until then, these are the data that we have.
So again, the discussion session that you led is really should be required watching or listening for every oncologist. That was really so great. I loved it. There's so many great things. Of course, the NATALEE trial had just been presented. Can you kind of summarize what was seen in NATALEE, compare that to what was seen with abemaciclib, and how you're processing where we're heading in that regard?
Sure. So I think in terms of breast cancer data, I would say that NATALEE were the most eagerly anticipated of the presentations. So NATALEE was a trial for patients who had high risk node negative, right? So it's different than MONARCH-E, which was all node positive. Natalie had high risk node negative, meaning if you had a T2N0 tumor, you had to have a high Ki-67, or you had to have a high genomic score, or you had to have a high grade tumor. It also included patients with node positive disease. So one of the big discriminators between Monarchy and Natalie was the inclusion of patients with node negative disease. The other big difference is that in this particular study, patients received 3 years of ribociclib versus not, as opposed to Monarchy, where patients received 2 years of abemaciclib versus not. Also in the Natalie study, the dose of ribociclib that was utilized was 400 milligrams, not the 600 milligrams that we think about in patients with metastatic disease. The other thing is that all the patients in Natalie received an aromatase inhibitor, right? Because from the Mona Lisa studies, we'd seen that you cannot give tamoxifen safely with ribociclib due to the QTC prolongation. So with about 27 months or so of follow-up, there was an improvement in invasive disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of about 0.75, and then also a distant disease-free survival advantage as well. So the data look promising. I will also say, and I'm going to be a bit editorial when I say this, the data to me are early, meaning that only about 20% of patients have actually finished their 3 years of ribociclib. And so I feel like we need additional maturity of these data. We said the same thing when we saw the results of Monarchy. Now we have 4-year invasive disease-free survival data where there's still this benefit after the patients have completed their 2 years of abemaciclib. I feel like the same should hold true when we think about ribociclib in the adjuvant setting, also understanding that at this moment it's not approved.
So one of the things I was curious about, I kind of always saw these CDK inhibitors as kind of the same. Maybe I'm trying to simplify it, but are there any sort of pharmacologic differences? Is there something different about ribo? This came out, you know, you see the survival benefit in metastatic disease. And, you know, initially it was like, well, why is it the trial design? And then I started hearing stuff about maybe it is a little different, you know, whether it's CDK4, CDK6. Any thoughts about that? And also new agents coming along?
Yeah. There is a difference in terms of their differential activity of CDK4 versus CDK6. There also were some data, preclinical data that have been presented, including data that Renate Jesselson and her lab, you know, from the Farber presented at San Antonio last year, just demonstrating palbociclib resistance compared to abemaciclib resistance, and they look different. And I think for some time, as you mentioned, because we saw the hazard ratio for PFS being similar amongst all the trials, we just assumed that it was all one and the same. But I'm not sure that's the case anymore. And that's, you know, after we saw the results of Paloma 2, the not having an overall survival advantage at ASCO last year, to me, I don't think about the agents in the same way. And also, as you mentioned, there are CDK4 specific targeted therapies. There are CDK2/4/6 inhibitors that are in development. We saw some of the data from CDK4 inhibitors and the developmental therapeutic session that were presented at ASCO. These are intriguing molecules that are early in development.
So, you know, one of the things that I was thinking about after your session that really struck me as a theme, and actually it was commented on in our session as well, and I was kind of thinking the two together, was something I hadn't thought too much about, was the issue of a dose reduction. And that came up a lot in the discussion session. And it actually made me start thinking about this in other cancers, because I started to think how important it was. And one of the things, if you remember, we showed a piece of video from Sarah Tolaney, who said something I didn't realize, which is there was very little dose reduction in the adjuvant abema study because people weren't used to it yet. And I was asking her, well, you know, how is it playing out in the metastatic setting? Because I forget how many, it was a pretty significant number of people who did not complete the abema. And she was like, almost all of my patients are getting through now because I do dose reduction. And this also came up with the Natalie trial in terms of to what extent they were doing dose reduction. So, you know, there's certainly a clinical research issue involved here and try to interpret the trials, but also a patient care issue. And I thought about all the work we do with nurses and, you know, whether or not they can be helpful in trying to keep people on these therapies. I mean, hopefully improving the cure rate. Any thoughts about that and whether or not we ought to be maybe focusing a little more on that issue?
Yeah. So two things. One, I think back to 2 years ago at ASCO, there's this initiative. This was in the oral presentation session. A group of advocates got together, and it's called the Patient-Centered Drug Initiative, something along those lines with those initials. And anyways, they surveyed oncologists, and they also surveyed a good number of patients. And the takeaway from that was patients are willing to start with lower doses and see if they can tolerate it. Are we really needing to always give the drug at the dose that is maximally tolerated? And is that an antiquated way, the way that we were thinking about giving and dosing cytotoxic chemotherapy? Do we need to do that with ADCs? Do we need to do that with TKIs? And so the second thing I was going to mention is that ASCO this year, Erica Hamilton presented updates from the MONARCH-E study. And one of the slides to me, and there were questions that were asked in the session based upon this, looked at the patients in terms of the amount of dose that they received, if they dose reduced. And the take home from this was, even if patients had lower doses, they had the same level of efficacy. And we saw this at ASCO the year before from the Mona Lisa studies, which showed that patients, if they were at 600, even if they were on lower doses of 200, 400, they did just as okay in the metastatic setting. So the question came up during that oral session of, why are we starting at the highest dose? Like, do we need to do this? And so I would say in my clinic, there are patients that I start at a lower dose. You know, we saw also in Erica's presentation that older patients dose modified, meaning if they were greater than 65 years of age, more than patients than if they were younger. So I have absolutely dose modified. And, you know, in clinic yesterday, I had to bring down abemaciclib to 50 milligrams twice a day for two patients. And it was comforting for me to have seen those data, because I could say to both of those patients, first of all, you're not succeeding because you weren't able to tolerate 150 milligrams. And also, we know that patients, if they're on a lower dose, still get benefit from the drug. And I do think that that's an important message that we should be conveying to our patients.
You know, there was another sort of theme that, at least in my mind, as I was watching that session, that I was kind of surprised at. And I had actually asked Sarah Tulaney about this, because I feel like almost every solid tumor program we do nowadays, if I look in the chat room, the first thing I'm going to see is, what about circulating tumor DNA? And it looks like maybe it's starting to head in your direction now, too. Any thoughts about that? And there was quite a bit of discussion during that discussion thing about whether or not that might be helpful, particularly in the adjuvant setting.
Yeah. So there were data that were presented from the Penelope-B study, Penelope-B being the study that looked at giving a year of palbociclib in patients who had high-risk hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative disease, which was a negative study for palbociclib. And what they looked at is the RaDaR assay, which is also a bespoke assay, where they look at the tumor tissue and then look to see if there's alterations in circulating cells. And for patients who had baseline ctDNA positivity, those patients did poorly, right? So there is definitely this continued theme that prognostically, if you have the presence of circulating tumor DNA, patients do worse. To me, utilization of circulating tumor DNA in early stage breast cancer is not quite ready for prime time. And the reason I think this is that we have seen multiple studies now showing that it's prognostically concerning, but we don't know its predictive implications. Meaning, one, we don't know in a prospective study, well, if I do scans at that time, what's the rate of having asymptomatic radiographic progression? But then also, if I switch the therapy, are patients going to do better or not? And so ultimately, if I check it now, all I'm going to do is worry, wait for them to develop metastatic disease, not knowing if I switch their therapy, if they're going to do better. And there are randomized studies that are going on now that are looking at randomization strategies to see if we could change the biology if a patient has a positive ctDNA.
Yeah, all the investigators say, you know, I don't do it, but when I see second opinions, I see people doing it. And I'm sure when you talk to your brother, he'll tell you about the colon data, which really does meet the criteria that you just described. So you have a general oncologist like your brother who's doing it in colon cancer. They're going to think about it in breast, although you guys don't have the data yet. Well, we'll see how that evolves. So a few more questions about ER-positive disease in terms of metastatic disease. I mentioned the issue of choice of CDK, and you know, I'm hearing more, and we showed data at the meeting, investigators using ribo. Are you doing that?
Yes. In the metastatic setting, I would say ribo is my preferred agent.
And then the other thing that, you know, is getting more and more attention is the post-CDK space, which has been, you know, not too exciting until fairly recently. Now we have oral SERDs. We have capivasertib, which hopefully is going to get approved. I don't know if you have any information on that. So assuming that capivasertib is approved, and I'm curious where you think it is going to be approved, and you have alpelisib out there already, where do you see things landing over the, you know, now and over the next year or two, particularly if CAP becomes available in terms of post-CDK? And also, we'll just throw in CDK after CDK as another thought.
So I think that this is the space in the next 2-3 years that we're going to see the greatest amount of change. That's my prediction. I do think that capivasertib is going to get approved. So that's the AKT inhibitor. These data were published from the Capitello study in the New England Journal of Medicine recently. In that study, patients received fulvestrant with or without capivasertib. Capivasertib is given 4 days on, 3 days off. There are some side effects with capivasertib, including diarrhea and also rash and a lower rate of hyperglycemia. What I don't know is whether it's going to be approved only in patients with PI3K AKT pathway alterations or everybody, because in the data that were presented, in the overall population, everybody seemed to benefit. In the population of those without an alteration or those with unknown status, there seemed to be a benefit, but we'll see if there's an all-coming approval or not. Because, you know, with elacestrant, the oral SERD that was approved, that was restricted for those with ESR1 mutations. So I do think capivasertib will be utilized in patients who have PI3K mutations. Do I anticipate that there will be some who utilize capivasertib instead of alpelisib? I do. I think alpelisib is an agent that has its fair share of toxicities, hyperglycemia. You utilize Claritin prophylactically to prevent rash. It's not the easiest agent to tolerate. And so we don't have, you know, AKT and then PI3K inhibitor data. You know, we don't know anything about sequencing. But I suspect what will happen is that we will utilize it in clinic and see if we are able to have patients tolerate that better than we do with alpelisib. The other thing that I will mention is that there are PI3K mutant-specific inhibitors that are coming down the pike. So if you have an H1047R mutation, there are drugs that are specifically targeting that mutation and not wild type, with the hope that you have even better clinical efficacy without the associated toxicities, and those are early in development.
I'm curious when the last time was that you started a patient on alpelisib.
It was about 2 months ago.
Really? So you use it?
I do. You know. And I have patients who it's a breeze. And then I have patients where they're like, wow, that was worse than any chemotherapy I ever had to receive.
Yeah. And I've heard quite a few of those stories. And, you know, it makes me wonder about, you know, what's more toxic, capecitabine or alpelisib?
Yeah. I mean, I think, and Neil, the other thing I just wanted to mention is this question about CDK4/6 after CDK4/6. We have clear data now that palbo after palbo is not effective. We have this from the PACE study. At ASCO, we saw the results of Palmira. That is not an effective strategy. We should not be doing that. We published data from Maintain in JCO recently, which demonstrated that ribo after palbo, there is some benefit in the metastatic setting. But again, that's a phase 2 study. It wasn't designed to be a confirmatory study. It's in NCCN guidelines now. But again, it's a small randomized phase 2 study. The data that we're really waiting to see next will be data from the post-MONARCH study, which is a randomized phase 3 trial of about 350 patients, which is looking at fulvestrant with or without abemaciclib. And so if that is a positive study, I do think that we may be thinking about sequencing directly of CDK4/6 inhibitor after each one another, primarily also because beyond like just global availability, abemaciclib and the CDK4/6 inhibitors are relatively well tolerated agents. And it's they're toxicities that we know and are familiar with. So that's why I think that that may be a real strategy as well.
And, you know, getting back to our earlier conversation, you know, comparing mechanism of action or comparing the CDK inhibitors, the other thing that's just, you know, really dramatic is the schedule. You know, using continuous versus intermittent therapy, you would think that would be a major difference, although I guess it's really hard to detect out what's going on here. So before we get over to triple negative disease, let's just get into HER2 low, as long as we're talking about metastatic HER2 negative or formerly HER2 negative disease. So, you know, we've had the data out there a little bit. How is it actually fleshing out in your practice? Let's start with hormone receptor positive patients. Are you thinking about it after capecitabine?
Yes. I would say that that's my ADC of choice, often after capecitabine. I will say in hormone receptor negative, HER2 low, I flip it. I give sacituzumab govitecan first, but that is exactly where I'm utilizing it in hormone receptor positive HER2 low.
Yeah, and I hear a lot of people talking about that type of algorithm. What about HER2 zero? Do you have those patients in your practice, or do you somehow find a little HER2 somewhere?
You know, there were data that were presented at ASCO from the group at MGH, which showed that the more times you biopsied and tried to find HER2 positivity, you know, if you did 5 biopsies, you were more likely to find some HER2 expression. You know, I think one, we're going to see the data hopefully soon from DESTINY-Breast06, which is including patients with ultra low, meaning if you even just have like teeny tiny amount of HER2 expression. So this could continue to change. You know, I think we're putting a lot of stress on our pathologists because it's not as exact of a science as we would like. You know, I think the other thing is, and I don't know if you were going to potentially ask this question as well, but if I had a patient with hormone receptor negative HER2 zero disease, and that patient has progressed through multiple lines of therapy, and I was running out of agents, is there a situation where I would try to get trastuzumab deruxtecan for that patient? I would.
I think I remember seeing a one-arm study where those people responded.
Yeah. There are data from the DAISY study where we saw a really small population, but we saw some benefit in that population.
I hear a lot of good responses to T-DXd and HER2 low, but when you look at the data, is like the more HER2 there, the better response, or not really?
Not necessarily. I like to tell this story. I have one patient who had significant liver dysfunction. When I started her trastuzumab deruxtecan, her bilirubin was a little shy of 10. And so I dose reduced it and had a lot of angst about whether it was going to cause injury, et cetera. I watched her weekly, you know, by checking labs, and watched as her bilirubin went to 18. And then I watched as her bili went down to normal.
Wow.
And it's that sort of experience. And I don't think I'm alone on this. Like this, when I explained to the patient, like, this is a Hail Mary. She got real benefit for some time with that drug. And, you know, this was a patient who was edematous, confused, you know, patient was starting to have real significant liver dysfunction. And then patient, you know, she was able to go back to work full time.
Yeah. And as I say, I've heard a bunch of stories like that. But, you know, the other thing about that I hadn't thought about, and Sarah Hurwitz brought it up in the editorial to the DESTINY study, is the issue of cardiac toxicity, which of course there is trastuzumab in there. But the thing I hadn't thought about is the fact a lot of these HER2 low patients have had anthracyclines. Mm-hmm. And like she was saying, she sends all these people to cardio-oncologists. So I'm curious how you think it through. Are you more concerned about the heart in these HER2 low patients?
I am. If patients have received an anthracycline, I am. I will say, like as an aside, in my HER2 positive population, I've really moved away from giving anthracyclines. And also, we're fortunate to have a cardio-oncology center here. And so if I have a patient that I'm utilizing HER2-targeted therapy, I often am sending them just to make sure that we're optimally managing their cardiac function so that I can continue that form of therapy.
So let's talk about triple negative disease. And first, the use of neoadjuvant therapy, neoadjuvant IO, specifically the 522 regimen. And what situations, how big does a tumor have to be to use a neoadjuvant therapy triple negative for you?
Yeah, usually T2 or greater. So 2 centimeters or greater, or node positive.
And in terms of, you give all these patients adjuvant therapy even if they've had a past CR?
I mean, that's the real debate. I would say the standard for now is Sarah Tilney's running a study through the cooperative groups called the OptiMice study, which is randomizing patients with a PCR to Pembro versus not. And that, I think, is likely to show that there's not a benefit for continuing the adjuvant pembrolizumab, but that's also why it's important for us to be doing this study. And until we see the results of that study, that's my default, is to do that.
Well, you know, you can always stop it too, I guess, if the patient has a problem, although you hate to see somebody get diabetes, or particularly if they're going to be cured. Let's talk about PARP inhibitors in general, and also in the Olympia situation. Can you kind of summarize where we are in terms of data, approvals, and for practical purposes, how are you approaching it both in triple negative and ER positive disease?
You know, because we're giving so much neoadjuvant treatment to patients based upon its prognostic information, anybody who has residual disease and has a BRCA mutation, I'm giving them olaparib if they have triple negative breast cancer. And that was the population that was included in Olympia. For the patients with ER positive disease, the extent of disease needs to be greater. So it's a higher risk population that was studied in Olympia. A common question that comes up, and actually a patient that I saw yesterday, was a patient who had 7 out of 7 positive nodes, hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative. And this question that came up of, okay, well, should I do PARP inhibitor first or abemaciclib first? I tend to utilize PARP inhibitor first and then go on to abemaciclib, depending upon how they're doing and if they're willing to take an additional 2 years of treatment.
So I'm kind of curious how you think through a patient, let's say BRCA germline mutation, who has a tumor that's under the bar, how you think through the risk-benefit of the equation. Kind of, if you have any kind of risk, it kind of seems like a lot of these people would say, where's my PARP inhibitor?
Right. I mean, I think that this is, so two things. One, if I had a patient who, say, had 2 nodes involved, and might not have been eligible for Olympia, this is where there's an absence of data, but also understanding that for trial purposes, they try to have just the highest risk patients, right? And so this is a patient that I would have that conversation with the patient. And if they were willing to take a year of olaparib, then I would try to get approval from it and argue for it. I think the other question is, what do you do in patients who have germline POBI2 mutations? And this is the sort of circumstance where I would maybe be convinced to also try to get a PARP inhibitor in that population, understanding that we really don't have data. But mechanistically, I could rationalize and justify that I think that they would have benefit.
I've heard people call POBI2 BRCA3.
I like that.
So, you know, obviously a key issue here is the downside. And I'm curious, I guess there are two issues. One is sort of the nuisance issue, nausea, vomiting, cytopenias, et cetera. But also the issue, and I think to me, one of the biggest issues in terms of lowering the bar, which is the question mark about AML and MDS, although it doesn't seem like in breast and even in ovary, you see very much of that when you do it in patients who have not had a lot of pre-existing disease. But what is your experience, particularly in the adjuvant situation, with tolerability, GI, et cetera, cytopenias, and any thoughts about MDS and AML?
For sure. You know, one of the benefits of being as old as I am, right, and having as many wrinkles as I do, is that I'm old enough to remember when PARP inhibitors first came on as part of the discussion. And my mentor at the time, Mary Ellen Moynihan, who was at MSK and focused on DNA damaging repair, I remember being in a clinical meeting and her saying out loud, how could we ever give PARP inhibitors to patients in the early stage setting, everybody's going to get leukemia. I remember her having real concern. The data have in breast cancer have not shown for this to be the case. With all the, you know, with the follow-up that we have not seen an increased rate of MDS, AML. That's quite comforting. Thankfully, we're not seeing that. To me, the toxicity that I really think about with patients and that I discuss with them is anemia, and then also potential gastrointestinal issues.
And how much of a problem have you found it to be?
I anecdotally have found it to be more of a problem in the metastatic setting, in more pretreated population. I have a few patients in the adjuvant setting who have, knock on wood, done well with limited issues with adjuvant olaparib.
So in ovary, they equate somatic and germline. So if you have somatic BRCA, they treat them exactly the same as BRCA. You feel the same way?
I feel like the jury is out still. Nadine Tong has data in the metastatic setting, which demonstrated a benefit with PARP inhibition in patients who had somatic BRCA, somatic PALB2, did not see a benefit in somatic CHK2 or somatic ATM. So we really should not be thinking about, oh, all of the DNA damaging repair mechanisms are the same. That's definitely not been seen. Were there ongoing studies, other studies? Like, for instance, we have a study that here that's being run out of MGH, which is looking at talazoparib in this population. I do think we need additional data. But to me, outside of a clinical trial, I would only utilize a PARP inhibitor in the metastatic setting for patients who have somatic BRCA or somatic PALB2.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about before when we were talking about HER2-low is, you know, I hear people talking about ADCs as targeted chemotherapy. And again, ADCs, like every cancer and every solid tumor now, they've got ADCs. But, you know, in a way, you know, you have, first of all, ADCs targeting TROP2, where there doesn't seem, you know, you just give it to everybody. And they say, well, there's more TROP2 in, you know, the tissue, so to speak. You have the HER2-low situation. You're saying HER2-0, you see responses. So I'm just curious how you view ADCs nowadays. Do you think it really is targeted? Because it kind of, you know, you have Dato-DXd, which I'm curious about also. I think I just saw press release a positive trial in lung.
Yes.
And I know it's being studied in breast as well. Any thoughts about ADCs? Any thoughts about Dato? And how targeted are ADCs?
Yeah, I mean, Dato, I will say that the first study that's going to read out is going to be in the hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative population, the metastatic population from TROPION-Breast01. So that may be the first approval. To me, it's a question of how precise is the target that we are evaluating, meaning, you know, the assays that we're utilizing, how precise are they? You know, we've seen data from the ASCEND trial and from TROPICS-02 for sacituzumab govitecan, where there's really, you know, regardless of TROP2 expression, there's benefit. But really, how reliable and precise is the assay? And that's what I can't help but wonder is, okay, if we had a better assay, do we think we could further discriminate this out? And I feel the same way about HER2, right? I feel like, you know, also to give historical reference, right, we had a study in the adjuvant setting that was looking at just trastuzumab for patients who were quote-unquote HER2-low, the NRG study, and that was a negative study. You know, trastuzumab deruxtecan is able to overcome that. So I do think that there may be this added benefit that we're seeing when we're adding in the payload. And also, I don't think that we have precise biomarkers assessments.
That's a great point. So last question is, what should I be looking for at San Antonio?
I think that the studies that we'll see read out in the next 6 months to year will be, I think we'll see hopefully data with Dato-DXd. Hopefully we'll see Destiny-Breast06. Hopefully we'll see Postmonarch at some point in the next year or so. We'll see when we see those data. Those are the kind of studies that I have top of mind that I anticipate we'll be seeing.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Kolinsky, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.